Blog Talk Radio. At the National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is your guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp. I want to welcome our callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join this show every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and 8 p.m. Central, where Bernice Alexander Bennett will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of the guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions of the guests. We have discussed the topic of mixed race in previous episodes. You may recall Professor Bernie D. Jones talking about her book, Fathers of Conscience, Mixed Race Inheritance in the Antebellum South. In another episode, Henriette Kane discussed Brown Babies, Germany's Forgotten Children. Tonight, we will have a more comprehensive discussion about mixed race. Stephen Riley is the creator of mixedracestudies.org, a non-commercial website that provides a gateway to contemporary interdisciplinary English language scholarship about the relevant issues surrounding the topic of multiracialism. This site has been called by a preeminent scholar, quote, the most comprehensive and objective clearinghouse for scholarly publications related to critical mixed-race theory, unquote, and by an up-and-coming scholar, quote, probably the singularly most viable tool in my work, unquote. Creator and founder Stephen Riley has been an information technology professional for nearly 30 years in the D.C. area and is currently Director of Database Development and Design at a trade association in Washington, D.C. His areas of expertise are application programming, database, and website development. Let me give a warm welcome to Stephen Riley to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Good evening, Stephen.
Hi, Natan. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes.
To have you.
And
with
also,
us.
I feel privileged to have followed up with Dr. Bernice, who wrote this the book about the inheritance of slaves, and also it's also great to be following up Edward Ball, who wrote Slaves in the Family. So it's really a pleasure to be here.
And we are happy that you've decided to join us. Let me begin by asking you, how do you define mixed race?
That is a great question. And I would define it right now, I would say that I would take, there were essentially two definitions. One, popular American definitions of mixed race, essentially people who are the products of two parents who are from different racialized backgrounds. A more comprehensive definition would be anyone whose ancestry is of multiple racial heritages. So, for example, you know, if you took that definition, you would have probably, I would say, a third of the country, and the vast majority of African Americans and Latinos would fall into that. So, it's kind of a vague definition, but that's how I would define it.
Next question: why did you create the mixedracestudies.org website?
I created the website partially because I was sort of interested in the topic. I'm married. I'm in interracial marriage. My wife is white. I'm black. I consider myself black. My wife considers herself white. And I wanted to create a site where people could sort of understand some of the issues. And before I even go further, I'd like to start with sort of a preamble and say that race is a problematic concept in many ways. Race is sort of a social construct. And when we start to talk about things, especially mixed race, we sort of reify the notion that race, that there are pure races. So I really like to let people know that, you know, race is a cautionary tale. And our problem with race is sort of that we, not that, you know, not only does race doesn't exist, but racism does. And the reason that racism exists where race doesn't is because of the belief in race. And I like to say that it's an analogy of witchcraft. You know, I use witchcraft as an analogy, essentially, where people believed in witchcraft, and they believed that people were witches, but the witchcraft wasn't real. But, however, the persecution was real, and the flames used to burn witches were real. So with that said, race, even though it's not real in the social construct, it has a very real impact on people's lives. And as such, when people cross racial boundaries to have children, to form marriages, it creates tension, creates a lot of discussion, and it's a long history in America. So that's one of the reasons I created the site.
Was there any particular inspiration for you creating this website?
Well, one of the things, or several things, of course, is the election of President Obama, who is of mixed heritage, but of course is our first black president. So that was one of the inspirations. Another one was we had a couple of friends come into town who were mixed and who were sort of encouraging us to vote for President Obama. A third one is where we live. We live in Silver Spring, Maryland, and it's a place where there's a lot of diversity, and there's a lot of interracial couples, and I like to joke sometimes that when we're in downtown Silver Spring, the only people who stare at interracial couples are other interracial couples. So those are the ongoing inspirations that sort of got me to sort of build the site.
Let me ask you this question. Would you explain why your website's focus would be the scholarly perspective on the mixed race experience?
Well, that's another good question. The reason I did that is I found that the contemporary discussions, particularly in the popular press, were poorly written, and for the most part they were ahistorical. So they didn't take any historical context. They had no historical context. They would continually focus on the very young, middle class, and they would forget that people have been crossing racial boundaries for centuries in the United States. So that's one of the reasons I focus on scholarly work, and the other reason is that scholarly work tends to be interdisciplinary, and also, because it's peer-reviewed, you know, there tends to be less errors, and it tends to be more robust. So that's the reason I focus on scholarly work.
I forgot to ask exactly approximately when the website was launched.
I launched the website in spring of 2009. And it's been since I launched the website. Right now, I have about half a million page views a month, and I'd say about 750,000 hits a month out of that. And I get over a monthly period over 35,000 unique visitors. So it's been quite successful.
Obviously, if you have scholars, preeminent scholars and up-and-coming scholars who found your website, so how did you get the word out there about it?
Well, there was several ways. I mean, when I first created the website, you know, I thought that scholars might just shrug their shoulders, you know, because my primary goal was for people who are not scholars. So I was trying to encourage people to read the scholarly work. And, but most people who came to the site are scholars. But slowly, I got the word out because I also had the privilege and the benefit of visiting an online chat called Mixed Chicks Chat with actress Fanchon Cox and Heidi DeRoe, who's an author. And I visited that chat every week, and I mentioned my site. So that helped get the word out, and I appreciate their active support in getting that out. And also, I actually reached out to scholars. That's another way I got out. One of my main influences is a professor named Dr. Reiner Spencer, who teaches at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And he's the one who really got me thinking critically about mixed race. And as he likes to say, he's a racial skeptic. So he questions the ideology of race. But one day I went out to he came into Washington, D.C. for a conference, and I suggested that I meet him for, you know, coffee right before, you know, the evening before his presentation. And he turned around and said to me, he said, you know, I can't do that because, you know, I normally come in for the morning and I leave in the afternoon. And he said, you know, one of my panelists isn't going to make it. Why don't you just come and deliver a paper? So I was like, instead of, you know, meeting him, I was delivering a paper, and that's pretty much how it all started. And then, you know, once I got over that, I think, hurdle of, you know, all of a sudden, wow, I'm on stage, I began to continue to write and be able to spread the word. And from there, I guess, you know, the rest is history.
And obviously you established some credibility when you were able to be part of this panel with this professor.
Yes.
So when
yes.
speaking with some of his colleagues, he also may have helped spread the word about your website. And then you got more scholars visiting
yeah,
your website.
And then more people, more followers, and then more links. And, you know, there you go. And so from there, you know, it just started. So I've done many, many things. I've you know, given a guest lecture at Brown University. I've participated in the Critical Mixed Race Studies conference at DePaul in 2010 and 2012. And, I've participated in about 20 things since I've started. And I really didn't anticipate doing that. I thought I'd just be a blog, you know, providing people with information. So it's turned out really great.
Let me follow up, because you mentioned the Critical Mixed Race Studies, or CRMS. Would you discuss that a little bit more, and then what separates that, the critical mixed race studies, from the more general mixed race discussions?
Critical mixed race studies is essentially is an interdisciplinary study that studies the role of not only the role of multiraciality, but the people who identify as mixed race and their relationship with racial formation and other topics within particularly sociology, but also in psychology and other fields. So one of the things that critical mixed race studies does is it critiques certain ideologies about mixed race, for example, whether or not people who are mixed race can sort of become bridges among people who are of different races, or whether or not interraciality can actually decrease racism, and also, whether you know, it also takes in consideration the long history of mixing and sort of brings that to the foreground in the discussion of race. So that's a significant aspect of critical mixed race studies, whereas the current discussion of, you know, with mixed race studies without the critical part simply looks at I would think it's a celebration of mixed race and sort of says, look how we've been mixing. For example, you know, people, there's a site out there that sort of celebrates the fact that in the latest Pew survey, that 15% of all new marriages in 2010 were mixed race or interracial. And it doesn't really look back at time periods like Virginia, colonial Virginia, where maybe 25% of all the marriages were mixed, and this was in the 1600s. So this is one of the advantages of critical mixed race studies as opposed to just plain quote-unquote mixed race studies.
Let me follow up on what you just said about colonial Virginia. During that time period, are we talking primarily Europeans and Native Americans getting married, or is it a broader range of how mixed race would be defined for that time period?
Well, first, it was Europeans and Native Americans, and we were talking colonial Virginia, and this is also a period before the planters made that fateful decision to use black African slave labor to do the work. But afterwards, as the tobacco, you know, after the original colonists sent there went to Virginia, they used indentured servants from Europe. So many of those servants were black and were white, or actually from Africa and from Europe. This is probably before the, you know, the ideology of race sort of was developed. And people intermarried. They worked together, indentured servants who were black and white worked together. They lived together. They loved together. They married each other until slavery took hold, until the planters decided to use multi-generational slave labor, then all of that changed.
It's astounding to hear you say that in colonial Virginia, interracial marriage was 25%, and people are celebrating today in 2010, and it's 15%.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the problems about race in America and about history in America is that we have such terrible amnesia. We forget, you know, and that's one of the I would say primary focus of my website is to take a long look at history and the importance of history. You'll see on my website, you know, hundreds of links that are historical in nature, hundreds of posts, I should say. So,
what aspect of the mixed race discussion do you see as most important?
Again, I would say really the most important aspect is the history of mixing and the importance of, I would say, the importance of the fact that we in this country have crossed racial boundaries for centuries, and that family formation has gone on like that forever, and we simply keep forgetting. I think another aspect we need to look at is that the importance of white supremacy when we discuss multiraciality, and how without the ideology of whiteness, really race multiraciality doesn't really exist, because without whiteness, the concept of race completely falls apart.
There's already a question coming out of the chat, and this goes back to our earlier discussion regarding colonial Virginia.
Yes.
The question is, in what year or years are you using as the turn from indentured to slavery?
I'm talking about before the first anti-miscegenation laws were enacted. They were pretty much enacted about 1661 in Virginia and 1662 in Maryland. So before that, that was a time period where people started to were mixing, and before the laws kicked in, And then after that, when you know when the colonists decided to use slavery, and that really started to kick into the 1690s, there were real punishments meted out. One of the things that should be noted is that English law stated that the birth of the child followed the father, essentially. But when slavery came around, when white men started to, you know, rape their slave, their female slaves, the law changed, essentially. So the birth of the baby, you know, essentially the baby followed the belly. So essentially that the children of slave women were slaves themselves. So that sort of kicked in after the late 1600s.
And yes, the person who asked that question followed up by posting 1662 status of children based on mother.
Yes. Yes.
Now you mentioned when you
go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean what happens is, you know, after that time period then is that's pretty much where everything pretty much changes. Where the tobacco plantation owners decide that they want to use slave labor, and when that happens, there has to be a clear delineation between who's black and who's white, so who's free and who's not free. So that's an important time period.
You mentioned that your website has links to historical articles or a number of posts. And I wanted to just let our listeners and chatters know that if you click on under categories, there's a section entitled History. There are 1,617 posts. For the
yes.
One at the top that I see right now has interracial families in 18th century Mexico.
Yes, that's my top post. Yes, that's outside of the North America, that's sort of Central America, but that's another story about, in particular, Costa paintings. And that's a story about how the Spanish sort of created these racial hierarchies and then sort of put it into paintings. So they sort of codified the racial hierarchy. So they had a whole list of people and different names, for a mulatto, you know, if a white person, an Indian and a black person was this, and a white person and an Indian was this. So it was a whole list of categories in what they call New Spain or Mexico. So that's a totally different, I wouldn't say totally different, but it's sort of a different aspect. And part of the site is, many the sections of the sites will take you to all different places. I sort of break them up into sort of Latin America and North America, and then I do break up Canada. But when it comes to the United States in particular, I break that up into sort of Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi. Those play really important roles. And I should add Virginia. They play really important roles.
Yeah, I see Virginia
roles
here.
There.
I was going to mention that.
Yeah. They play really important roles in the development or the discussion of mixed race throughout history.
And now you've informed our listeners and chatters that your website is not just focused on the United States. There's a global perspective.
As much as I can. It's English language. I should say that there's, you know, the discussion of mixed race is a global one, and a lot of the discussions, particularly in Latin America, is in Portuguese language and in Spanish. And if you go to some parts of the Caribbean, it's in French. So you'll see most of the emphasis on North America. But there are some English language scholarship that covers those areas too.
Okay. I'm going to ask a couple. They may seem more like technical questions, but just to help all of us get a better understanding. What criteria, if any, do you apply in determining which scholarly articles will appear on your website? For example, I've noticed you will have newspaper articles on mixed race issues. So do newspaper articles automatically appear, and are those considered scholarly or more general?
A lot of them are not necessarily scholarly, but they do have quotes from scholars. So
okay.
I include those. Those are important ones. And then some, you know, I made the decision, I would say about 2-3 years ago, to make Barack Obama a category. I was reluctant to make an individual category, but he was discussed so much, I had to sort of make him a category. And I you know, one of the other scholars I talked to was a professor, G. Reginald Daniel, who teaches at University of California, Santa Barbara, who's a preeminent, another preeminent expert on it. And he said, yeah, you know, you can't really talk about multiraciality without somehow talking about President Obama and his background as being a black man of mixed heritage. So, you know, that's another category that I have there. So I have articles about Obama that aren't necessarily scholarly, but sort of reflect his view of his own identity and his relationship with America. So that's why I include that. So it's not a, you know, I wouldn't say it's exclusively scholarly. I think I started off that way, but then I wanted to be able to at least get people to pull people into the site. I think some people might get intimidated if everything was a scholarly article. So
I understand. And if someone happened to click on your website, and I have posted the link to your website in the chat room, and you click on under categories on Barack Obama, the top article, at least right now, is Obama Bears His Blackness and Trayvon's Speech. So the issues of race are brought up even in the top article that you have on that particular post.
Yes, I have to say that in the 4.5 years that I've started this site, I think the last, I want to say 3 months, have been the most dynamic in the entire period. I don't think we've had such a discussion about race in America as we've had, at least within, when I say a dynamic discussion, I mean, you know, now that we have things, you know, social media like Twitter and Facebook, I just can't remember the last time. This has been the most dynamic discussion we've had. And I would say things like the Boston Marathon bombing, the Cheerios ad sort of pseudo-controversy. We have those two Supreme Court cases on the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action, and, of course, the Florida versus Zimmerman case. And then lastly, you know, as you just mentioned, Obama's remarks about race. And it's just really dynamic. It brings to the forefront the concept of race in America. And people, you know, I think we were discussing, I guess maybe last night, how race was, you know, how race shapes America. I sort of say how race really defines what America is, does more than just shape it. And it really reminds us that, you know, I hate to use the term, you know, post-racial, and I even, you know, almost now even hate the term not post-racial even more. So it sort of reminds us that we are very much a racialized society.
What was it about the Boston Marathon that generated a lot of discussion?
Well, there was discussion about the accused bombers on their, you know, they were from the Caucasus, but they were also Muslims. So there was this debate of whether or not white people could be, or Caucasians could be Muslims, you know. So there was some debate that said, hey, you know, they're from the Caucasus. That's where Caucasian comes from. They have to be Caucasian. They have to be white. And then other people discussed it, said, look, whiteness and race is a social construct. So whiteness is whatever the dominant group thinks it is. So that's that. I think that started off, and that was April 15th, I think. So that started off what I call the long, hot summer of race that still seems to be going on right now.
Interesting. You mentioned the Cheerios ad. Would you elaborate on that?
General Mills, the maker of Cheerios, created, I think, at least an online ad that featured an interracial couple and their child. And the ad has the white mother talking to her mixed-race daughter, discussing the benefits of Cheerios and how it could benefit their, you know, your heart. And then I think that was the beginning of the scene. The end of the scene, her father is sleeping on the couch, and he's got Cheerios all over his chest, as if the daughter thinks that pouring the Cheerios over his chest would help his heart. So it's a very cute ad in and by itself. Apparently, according to General Mills, it was a YouTube ad, there were a lot of hate comments on it, and they took them off. And I'm sure there were, you know, hate comments, and I don't. I'm sure if you've ever seen YouTube, you'll see a lot of comments and how they can be very, very racist. So General Mills claimed that they took the comments down, and it sort of created a buzz in itself. And unfortunately, I would say unfortunately, is that we never really got to see the negative ads. We never had a chance to actually sort of confront the bigotry that was expressed in the ads. Another issue that I brought up that a lot of people seem to overlook is that in a lot of ads that depict interracial couples, there's a strong reluctance to show any kind of intimacy. And in this particular ad, you know, it's not really a problem per se, but you don't see that in a lot of ads. And you don't see that in this one too. So I was not – I don't want to say I was critical of the ad, but I think there's – I think General Mills could do more. They could probably, you know, shoot another ad with the same family and have them all sitting at the table. So those are the kind of things. I don't know. Did you get a chance to see the ad yourself?
I did.
Okay.
And you do have the daughter interacting with the mother, and
yeah.
You, as you describe, and then later on, the scene shifts with the father who's on the couch.
Yes.
And he wakes up, and he has Cheerios all over his chest.
Yes, yes, exactly. And it's a cute ad in it by itself, but I've seen several ads on television depicting interracial couples and families where if you blink, you don't see it, you know, where – the advertisers seem skittish about putting people physically close to each other that are of different racialized groups. And I feel like after the Cheerios ad, I feel like there's a real sense of disappointment on because they haven't generated more ads on interracial couples. People turned around and said, oh, well, what's the big deal? Well, if that wasn't such a big deal, why don't we see more ads like that? And it's been 2 months since they've done that.
Let's take a minute break, and we'll resume our discussion.
Okay.
National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is the guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp, and you are listening to Stephen Riley, creator and founder of MixedRaceStudies.org. I want to remind everyone that all of these shows are archived and available immediately after the broadcast as a podcast. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. And of course, chatters, if you have a question, just please post them in the chat room. Stephen, we're talking about General Mills and their advertisement for Cheerios. And that
yes.
leads me into another question. Evaluate
okay.
for us how well or not the media frames the public's understanding of mixed race issues. And by media, is your focus solely the news media, or would media also include the entertainment industry?
Media would be both, and I think media does a terrible job of discussion of mixed race. And in fact, media takes a very ahistorical viewpoint about mixed race. So I'm talking about newspaper articles. I give a good example. There was a story about, I think the New York Times had a series called Race Remixed. And their focus was on youth in America. You know, so they didn't take a look back and look to see how long people had been mixing. They started to look at places like, in one of the articles, they looked at the census results of people who were born and marked more, two or more races in Mississippi, and they compared that from 2010 to 2000, and they claimed it was a 70% increase, and it went from something like 0.8% to 1.17%. So they distorted numbers. If you look at the discussion of multiraciality in the media, they promote the notion that mixing in and by itself is going to lead us to a post-racial society. That has never been the case because we've been mixed for centuries. So there's this notion that somehow we're evolving into a mixed-race society, which is not the case. So we've always been that way. When it comes to entertainment industry, it's even, you know, I don't know how you can say, you know, just, you know, once you've, you know, dug yourself a hole, you find another shovel. And I think when it comes to the media, popular media, it's even worse. So media, again, likes to sort of use the same sort of pop ideology that somehow mixed race people will save us all. You know, there are saviors. And it simply isn't true.
I'm going to mention a program that I've watched. The BBC produced a very popular show, which concluded recently. The show,
yes,
The Adventures of Merlin, is loosely based on the legend of King Arthur. I'm just going to give a sort of a background in case not everyone's familiar with this show. The show reimagines the relationships of the main characters and how those relationships formed when the main characters were late teens to early adults. The actress who played Guinevere, or Gwen, is an actress of mixed race heritage, including African roots. How do you evaluate the entertainment industry taking such a huge leap with the legend of King Arthur by using a mixed race actress to portray a character who traditionally has been viewed as a blonde with blue eyes?
I would say in that situation, it's a British production, so the Brits seem to be able to take or are willing to take more risks like that. So I do applaud them for that. So remember, it's not an American television program. So I think that's one of the reasons they're able to do that. I would also mention that I don't want to give any spoilers, but after season five, and I did watch the program for 3 years, so I enjoyed it too. I guess you watched it too.
Yes.
And I enjoyed the series because I actually enjoyed it more because Gwen sort of how I enjoyed how Gwen rose from the ranks. She was a servant girl and became
Correct.
Queen. So
yes.
That really fascinated me, and the fact that she was black, and you know, also her brother was one of the knights too, as you recall.
Yes.
So that was a different plot twist, and I appreciate British television for doing that. So I think when you're discussing that, I think there's a difference. I think we have to talk about the differences between in British portrayals of mixed race and interraciality and American portrayals of interraciality. When it comes to American portrayals of interraciality, many times the depictions are used to sort of portray deviancy, add an edge to a character to show how far a character has fallen. For I would say I give an example of a movie. I think the kids are all right. I think in the beginning of the film, the white character, the lead character, is down in the dumps and he's got a black girlfriend. And then you know, sort of he comes up through the dumps. You know, comes and. And so it goes out in the sunset with someone who's white. So that's a really good example of how interraciality or the depiction of interraciality can be used to sort of demean interracial couples. And I think that's there are many other examples. I would say the author Erica Cheeto Childs has a really excellent book out there called Fade from Black to White, and it's sort of a book about how these things, how interracial couples are depicted, and also more importantly, who controls the media. And I think there's not a lot of discussion about that.
Yes, and just by the examples you've given, it shows how powerful the entertainment industry can be in terms of shaping, and maybe sometimes we're not realizing they're giving us subconscious messages about whether those relationships are appropriate or not.
And in two ways, in one, in what we see, and also in what we don't see. So when we don't see certain things, that sort of reinforces the notion that maybe these things shouldn't exist, these relationships shouldn't exist. So I think after reading her book, I started to reexamine things that I saw and started thinking about things that I didn't see.
Let me pull back to a broader perspective and get away from just the entertainment industry. What is the mixed race landscape in terms of movements, ideologies, groups, figures?
Oh, that is a broad question. I think you have to let's start, you know, piece by piece. I guess there are several. You can't really define the movement in monolithic terms. It's sort of asking, you know, about different racialized groups, or, you know, can you tell me about this particular, you know, voting bloc, or you're trying, you know, it's very, very broad. And also it's also divided in many ways by quote unquote the mixes. I don't want to reify, you know, races again, but people who are, let's say, Asian of white ancestry and black and white ancestry, there's a different dynamic there, so it's hard to say what the different movements are per se. But I would say among people who are mixed, one of the major ideologies would be the right to self-identify. I think that's one of the big ones right now, is that people feel the right to choose their identity and feel the right to change the identity when it suits them. So that's a major consideration. Right now, there's really no political movement. Since the census has been changed, there really isn't any political movements to actually change the census. There's no desire to, you know, the census has the mark all that apply. So, and that's going to stay the way it is for duration. Also,
so that's the change
I think
you're referring to.
I'm sorry?
Just to clarify, that's the change you're referring to, mark all that apply.
Yes. Before 2000, there was no option. After the year 2000, people have the option to choose their identity. They could choose one or more races for their identities. So Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to clarify that point.
Yes. So now I should also add, from for a historical perspective, 2000 wasn't the first year the census enumerated people were mixed. Actually, they did that in 1850, where they had the term mulatto added to it, to the census. Now, in those days, people didn't fill out census. Census takers took census. So I should add that. The other aspects of multiraciality, I think, is another one. It's a sort of the and I think this is somewhat of a false narrative. I'll get into this later on. Is sort of the celebration of Loving versus Virginia case, and the notion, which I think it's false, that case sort of heralded in a multiracial baby boom in the 60s, which is I don't believe is true at all. So
let's stop right there, because I think people would like to hear more about that.
Okay, well, you know, for people who don't know, Loving versus Virginia was a landmark Supreme Court case in 1967 that ended the last of the anti-miscegenation laws in 15 states, and the 16th state was Actually, some people say 15, some people say 16. The reason people say 16 is when the Lovings actually went to have their argument in front of the Supreme Court on April 10th, 1967, the state of Maryland had already repealed its anti-miscegenation law in September of 1966, but that didn't take effect until June of 1967. So when the decision was actually laid down in June 12th, there were actually 15 states instead of 16. But the Lovings were a couple that met in a community in Central Point, Virginia, in Caroline County, and I think you mentioned you have a connection to that county.
Yes, I did.
Yes. And they grew up in a community that was racially complex for generations, and I think that that's sort of lost on people. And Mildred Loving herself was a woman who has been depicted as black, but she had Indian ancestry too, and actually in many narratives identified personally as Native American. But she met her person who soon would be her husband in about 1950, and he was 17 and she was 11. Now, the age gap there implies, of course, that there was family consent. The families met, the families knew each other, and that was fine with the families because the community was fine with that. So this was one of these stories that wasn't a Romeo and Juliet story. This was a story about families that loved each other and couple that loved each other. And what happened was they we'll fast forward to June of 1958, and Mildred Loving discovered she was pregnant. They could not get married in Virginia because Virginia had a statute known as the Racial Integrity Act that was passed in 1924 that restricted such marriages. And they went to the district. They drove to the District of Columbia to get married. And at that time, about half of the states had miscegenation laws. There were 48 states at that time. 24 states had anti-miscegenation laws, and 24 had repealed them or had none at all. And then, and District of Columbia was one of them. So they went to the District of Columbia, got married, came back to Central Point where they wanted to live out their lives. And a few weeks later, they were woken up out of their beds and arrested and thrown into jail for violating the part of the law that prohibited leaving the state to get married in order to live in Virginia. So some of the part of the false narratives about Loving versus Virginia is that they fought to get married. They did not ever fight to get married. They fought to really to live in Virginia. And so essentially that sort of led to their saga. They got, you know, they were found guilty of violating that aspect of the law and were sentenced to exile out of the state for 25 years.
Wow.
Now, what most people don't know, and I didn't know until about 2 years ago when I saw the film. There was a film by Nancy Byrowski, and I'm sure I butchered her name, but it was called The Loving Story. It's on HBO for anyone who's interested. Essentially, the Lovings secretly moved back to Virginia. They couldn't live in D.C. They were sort of exiled in D.C., and they sort of fought their case all the way to the Supreme Court while secretly living in Virginia. And the film, the documentary, sort of covers that aspect of the story. But one of the aspects of anti-miscegenation law that's really, really important, and one is what I call the false narratives. I'll take you to a sort of a different story and come right back to that. I remember going out to Kentucky with my wife, and we went to visit the home of Henry Clay, the politician. And
yes,
all
the compromises that ultimately fell.
Yes. And we took a tour, and we said, wow, this is a big mansion. And we sort of joked. I said, you know, he had lots of help. He must have had help. And my wife said he had lots of help. And but the tour guide and the sign said something, you know, because we both said, yeah, well, he owned slaves. And this tour guide said Henry Clay enslaved as many as 60 people. And I was struck by the word enslaved. I never heard that used in such a way. You know, people have often used the word own slaves because it's sort of a passive you know, it's very passive. But when you say enslaved, it's very active. So words have meaning, and I sort of really, after I heard the word enslaved, I started to think that, you know, he was out there, you know, actively impressing the people that he owned, and he could sell them at any time. And I use that sort of analogy to talk about loving versus Virginia and the importance of the anti-miscegenation laws. People like to describe these laws as sort of keeping people from keeping loving couples from marrying each other. And they had a much more insidious effect than that. They were part of Jim Crow, the Jim Crow laws that sort of reinforced the notion that black people and white people were inherently different, and that black people were inherently inferior. So not only did black people and white people should not be in the same beds, they shouldn't be in the same churches, they shouldn't be in the same schools. And I think that message is sort of obscured in the way people describe Loving versus Virginia. They don't really discuss the real significance of white supremacy and oppression of people of color using those laws. And as Peggy Pasco says, and she's an author of a really great book called What Comes Naturally, Miscegenation Laws and the Making of Race in America, what she really emphasizes is that anti-miscegenation laws were essentially the cornerstones of white supremacy.
Someone has a question regarding the Lovings. Are they still alive?
Mildred Loving died. Richard Loving died in a car accident in 1975, and Mildred Loving died in spring of or summer of 2008. I would say both the Lovings had three children: a daughter, Peggy Loving Fortune, and two sons. Those two sons are deceased. Peggy Loving Fortune is still alive. I saw her at there was a screening of the film The Loving Stories here in Silver Spring, and she was part of the panel that was on stage. And so one of the interesting stories, she's the only surviving child, but she complained a little bit because she saw her mother. She believed her mother was Indian, Native American, not black.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I use Peggy Loving's Fortune as another interesting story in it by itself, because she identifies, at least on her census, when she filled out the census in 2010, she checked only one box. She checked Native American. And, of course, we all know that President Obama only checked one box, too. He checked African-American. So I think that's a pretty interesting connection between the two individuals there.
That is, and it's interesting that even though you have the option for these individuals to check all that apply, chose instead to...
That's an interesting segue. Actually, at the last Critical Mixed Race Studies conference, I would say, actually, when you asked me the question before, what are the movements, I would say another significant movement is within academia. There's a new study of mixed race now. So the conference, the first conference was in 2010, the second was in 2012. And I delivered a paper at the conference on the racialized identity of President Obama. I made the argument that President Obama is actually a black president, not a mixed race one, not a white one, and Obama is the source of much discussion among people and many arguments.
I think about how it has been revealed several times in the news before he was actually elected the first time, when people traced his mother's line, that he was like an eighth cousin of Cheney, and he was connected to I forgot whom else. But there were famous people living today and those in the past that genealogists discovered because of his mother's line that he was connected to.
Yes. Yes, what was the guy's name? John, I can't remember his name now. It's blanking on me right now. But he showed that he was related to a black indentured servant, I believe, or black slave. And which
Virginia.
Yes, it was Virginia. Of course, Virginia is the root of all of this, you know, sort of the ground zero for you know, crossing racial boundaries. That's hardly a surprise. I mean, again, I think if people – one of the books I often suggest is a book by Daniel Sharfstein. It's called The Invisible Line, Three Families and Their Secret Journey from Black to White. And he traces three families and how they become – they're essentially mulatto slaves, mixed race, and become, you know, indentured servants. Actually, in one particular family, actually within 50 years went from being indentured servants to actually owning slaves and becoming planters. And then eventually their descendants become generals in the Civil War and the Confederacy. So when people talk about mixed race, and I guess here's another example why it's so difficult to define that in so many ways is, you know, we all sort of are willing to agree that significant numbers, 70 to 95% of all people who are quote-unquote African-American have what we could say heterogeneous ancestry, but significant numbers of people who are white do so too. And in some instances, that doesn't, of course, you know, the quote-unquote one-drop rule doesn't always apply. So, that's a certain part of history that people don't really understand.
That's true, and we're going to talk about that one-drop rule on the other half of the break. Anything
okay.
else that you want to say before we take a break?
No, I think I'm looking forward to break. It sounds like if we're going to talk about the one-drop rule, we're going to have to take a break for that.
Okay, well, this is a great time to take a minute break, and we will return in a minute, folks.
Okay.
National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is the guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp, and you are listening to Stephen Riley, creator and founder of MixedRaceStudies.org. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. Stephen, the one-drop rule. Kind of a brief overview for those. I think everyone should be aware of it, but just in case some are not familiar.
Oh, the one-drop rule is sort of the belief that anyone in particular with any known African ancestry is considered black. It was created to sort of disenfranchise African Americans from property, from resources, just about anything, to make them second class citizenship. The ironic thing about the one drop rule is that it's sort of a double edged sword, because it sort of had a way of unifying black people of all different shades.
Exactly.
Yes. So.
And with DNA testing now, particularly autosomal DNA testing, when it reveals for the specific individual their makeup, it may be shocking for some individuals to find out they have a couple of drops of African
blood.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. So, yeah, that, you know, again, I'm a little careful about when talking about DNA, because there's certainly limitations about with DNA testing. I think what it does really well is it connects living people. You know, it has a difficult time, you know, connecting people to the past. You know, the population groups that are in certain parts of the world now aren't the same population groups that were there 300 years ago. So, you know, that's a problem when we talk about DNA. But yes, you're right. There's if you were to look at DNA for many, many people, you would find that people do have heterogeneous ancestry, in particular Black Americans and in particular Latinos.
A question, or actually a comment coming out of the chat, says, I think the one drop rule is fading and the expectation of many biracial people may be fading as they often marry white partners in the next generation. Exceptions exist, of course.
Well, I think that really depends. I mean, you've got a person like President Obama who married a woman who is arguably Black. Of course, her ancestry is mixed too, as we know. But, you know, it really depends on you know, identities. And I wouldn't argue with, you know, with the notion that people are marrying people who are white. I don't know. We'd have to look at the statistics on that. I think what's more interesting is how the children of those unions identify. For example, if two people who are mixed get married and have children, how do those kids identify? So... And by the way, your question about Obama's mother, her father or her descendant was named John Punch.
Yes.
From Virginia.
I do recall there was an article, I can't remember if it was in USA Today. It came out just before the general election, this most recent general election for president. Let me give a concrete example of someone who is mixed race and is a lightning rod to a certain extent, more because of some activities on the personal side, Tiger Woods.
Yeah, oh yes.
Tiger Woods, as I think most individuals may be aware, he has a multiracial heritage. His father's ancestry includes, my understanding, Black, white, and Native American, and his mother has Thai heritage.
Yes.
I find it fascinating that someone like him, and maybe it would be different if we were outside of America, but in America, there's an insistence on putting him in a straitjacket to a certain extent and saying he's Black.
Yes.
How come he's not viewed as being part Thai or Southeast Asian?
Well, that's a great question. If we step back a little bit, you know, after Tiger Woods won the Masters tournament, I think he was on the Oprah Winfrey Show, where he sort of described himself as being Kaplan Asian. So he sort of included all those identities or all those racialized identities, and sort of claimed that identity. And there are two issues when we come to discuss people's identities. One is sort of a psychological construct, where sort of people believe that they can sort of identify any way they want, and that sort of was that notion was sort of promoted for a while, but sort of took hold after Dr. Maria Root sort of produced her Bill of Rights for racially mixed heritage. So that took off. Another concept, essentially, that's probably stronger is that race is a social construct. And essentially, rather than you are who you say you are, it's you are who we think you are. So that's – in America, race is very much a social construction. So lots of people saw Tiger Woods as black. And then, as you mentioned, when he got into his bits of troubles, his black identity came, his perception of black was even stronger, or his perception of being black was even stronger.
Someone posts, isn't race also a political construct?
What most certainly is. I mean, I would say, you know, race affects everything in our lives today, unfortunately, particularly in America. If we look at race in different countries, it operates a little differently. But yeah, in America, you know, it's getting to be a political construct. If we look at places like in the South, where the Republican Party is attempting to turn the Democratic Party into a black party, into the Republican Party into a white party. So essentially, those are going to be the dividing lines there. So yes, I would agree with that.
We've focused, before getting to Tiger Woods, we talked more along the lines of black, white, mixed races. But let's discuss just briefly your non-black/white mixed race individuals. For example, you could have a child whose parents are Asian and Latino, or the Attorney General for the state of California, I think is Kamala Harris, whose mother is from India and whose father is from Jamaica. How do the media handle and project to the broader American public such non-traditional mixed race pairings?
Well, again, the media does a fairly lousy job, I think, and that's why I turn to sort of academic portray or academic explanations or descriptions of those kind of pairings. When it comes to the, I guess, you know, I'll divide those into the sort of the non-the double minority mixes, like the attorney general. And differentiate that from the sort of white non-black mixes. When it comes to those mixes, I guess, you know, there's some ambiguity there and how they're perceived. And you know, I don't know how do you know how the attorney general identifies? Does he identify as mixed or you know, do you have any sort of inkling on that? Or
I've seen one article listing up and coming Indian politicians, and she was listed.
Okay.
So I did see her one time counted in that category.
So it varies, you know, a lot. I would say what's more interesting is people of white, Asian, and white Latino identity ancestries. A lot of people, when they discuss these particular mixes, they talk about the concept of expanding whiteness. So they question whether or not these individuals will, in fact, identify, whether or not they'll identify as being mixed, or will they essentially identify as being white. And in many cases, some, you know, in the cases of people who are Asian descent, where they're often referred to as honorary whites, many sociologists take the viewpoint and they look forward and they also look backwards at you know, the Irish Americans and the Italian Americans, who people often forget had their whiteness questioned 150 years ago. Many people suspect that we're going to end up with rather than a white non-white divide, with rather a black non-black divide. So we may see, in 50 years, we may still see a very large white majority, not a white minority, because many people of mixed white or Asian and Latino ancestry may simply identify as white.
And the point you just brought up, I recall the Washington Post having an article about that very point, the divide between black and non-black.
Yes.
And the shaping of America maybe in the future. The question about, or am I raising the background about the Attorney General for the state of California has raised a couple of comments, like what race is Jamaican? I guess I wasn't trying to say that. Some people describe her father as a Jamaican-American. And so I'm not trying to put a race on Jamaican. My understanding is he is of a more African heritage, but that's how it's described in an article that I read. Someone else says, "And what about Soledad O'Brien?"
That's a great question. I want to go back to the Jamaican response, because some people in the Caribbean, and not to make a sort of pejorative comment about them, but some want to distance themselves from Black Americans, so they'll say they're Jamaican or Dominican. So people have different identities, you know, especially when they come to the United States. They know some people come to the United States not knowing that they're Black. So,
they came from, that you didn't have that consciousness. And so shocking.
Absolutely. And if you go to places like Brazil, where the idea of race isn't so much salient as the idea of color, essentially, skin color. And I think you mentioned that in Brazil, in at least the last census, people self-describe themselves in 136 different ways, different
colors.
That's
amazing.
So that's really amazing. Now, talking about Soledad O'Brien, that sort of segues into a couple of things. You know, she is identifies as Afro-Latino, and should remind people that the census sees Latino or Hispanic as an ethnicity, not a race per se. That
Correct.
May change in the 2020 census, where they essentially let people, you know, just choose whatever they feel like, you know, their ethnicity is or race. But she sees herself as Afro-Black, or Afro-Latina. And she did the most recent Black in America 5. Well, actually, she is the host, ongoing host of Black in America, and she's done 5 and is contractually agreed to do 2 more. And she sees herself as Black also.
You mentioned something, and I wanted to follow up on this. You talked about how when some individuals come from the West Indies or Central America or South America, and their complexion and hair texture may seem more akin to what some African Americans look like in this country, they distinguish themselves or want to distinguish themselves by saying, no, I'm Dominican or I'm Jamaican. You may recall this. I believe there were articles, at least one in the Washington Post, maybe 10 years ago, talking about the tension between Black Americans and Africans or people from the West Indies and Central and South America coming to the United States. There was actually tension between the two groups. Each had stereotypes about the other.
Yeah, yes. Well, I mean, I don't know the particular articles, but Blackness in America, you know, Black people have been demonized in the United States. And that demonization gets exported around the world, unfortunately. So that's one of the reasons why people may not want to identify that way when they come, depending on their complexion. I think that would be a pretty good explanation of why that is. I think another interesting side story to that is people who don't look quote-unquote African-American, but identify as such or identify as Black. And that's probably one of the, I guess, newer trends that are in the discussion of mixed race. So,
well, we're getting at the point of almost 10:15, and so I need to start wrapping up tonight's show. Unfortunately, we would love to have you back, by the way, to continue this discussion.
Yeah.
What are the future trends that you see in the discussion of mixed race?
I should let people know that there is a forthcoming journal, there's an inaugural journal that's dedicated to discussion of mixed race. It's called the Journal of Critical Mixed Race Studies, and it's sort of coming out of University of California, Santa Barbara. So that's going to be a journal that will come out twice a year, and it will be online and accessible to everyone. I also say that some of the new trends in multiracial studies are the inclusion of what's often termed whiteness studies. So they're looking at, at multiraciality through the lens of whiteness and or white supremacy or white privilege and how that shapes multiracial identities and how people identify on that. Another interesting topic, I guess, is sort of the policing of racial identities. And, you know, I think you remember concepts of paper bag tests and people sort of including or excluding people from racialized groups. I think that occurs a lot within the popular websites where people sort of claim, you know, here's a list of celebrities who are multiracial, whether or not they actually identify as such. And then a last book I want to talk about is a woman named Yaba Blay, who teaches at Drexel University. She has a new book coming out called One Drop, The Shifting Lens of Race, where she sort of, it's a photo essay book that looks at people who may or may not be considered African-American or you know, who may have their African ancestry dismissed, who clearly embrace it. And it's a real fascinating book, and it sort of challenges the current visual aesthetics on defining who is mixed in America. So I think that is going to be out later this year. So those are one of the many, many trends that are coming out in discussion of mixed race. And, of course, the last thing, I guess, is pretty much is I say in many ways is up in the air, is after President Obama's press conference on – or I shouldn't say press conference, remarks on Friday, where he sort of yet again reasserted his black identity, is that, you know, he's been a sort of uncomfortable icon for the people in the mixed-race community, and I think finally he may no longer be an icon. So I wonder if this Trayvon Martin decision and this long, hot racial summer will cause a rethink about multiraciality.
That's interesting, and I have to say, if people want to follow that, they should check your website periodically to see what the trends are that are developing on that particular issue as well as others.
Yes, I think I've only scratched the surface, and I would really encourage people to read the articles and read the books and read the authors who know far more than I do about the topic. And they can learn as much as I can, too.
Well, I want to say you've definitely demonstrated your wealth of knowledge on this topic. And I want to thank you, Stephen, for being a guest on the show tonight. Well, let me explain to listeners and chatters what's coming up in the month of August, because August is right around the corner. Starting next Thursday, August 1st, the guest speaker will be Dr. Sidney Nathan. He has written a book called To Free a Family. It is the story of Mary Walker, an enslaved woman from North Carolina who escaped bondage in 1844, left her children and mother behind, and spent 17 years seeking to recover them through ransom, ruse, or rescue. Sidney Nathan's PhD is an emeritus professor of history at Duke University and a recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundations. There will be a repeat episode on August 8th. On August 15th, join the show. The guest speaker will be Michael W. Twitty, and he will be discussing African-American foodways. So we whet your appetite on July 18th with Dr. Lenny A. Sorensen, and we're going to continue discussions about food. Michael Twitty is a food writer, independent scholar, culinary historian, and historical interpreter who is personally charged with preparing, preserving, and promoting African-American foodways and its parent traditions in Africa and her diaspora. He will highlight and address food's critical role in the development and the definition of African-American civilization and the politics of consumption and cultural ownership that surrounds it. On August 22nd, we'll have a historical viewpoint about mixed race, because the guest will be Dr. Joshua Rothman. He has written a book entitled Notorious in the Neighborhood, Sex and Families Across the Color Line in Virginia, 1787 to 1861. In this book, Dr. Rothman examines the full spectrum of interracial sexual relationships under slavery, from Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, and the intertwined interracial families of Monticello and Charlottesville to commercial sex in Richmond and the routinized sexual exploitation of enslaved women and adultery across the color line. Professor Rothman is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Alabama. Finally, on August 29th, the guest speaker will be Dr. Maggie Morehouse. She will discuss slave life and documents, primary sources regarding Edgefield and slave laborers. This show will focus on uncovering primary sources that reveal the interior lives of enslaved people, specifically highlighting data from Edgefield, South Carolina's laborers. In addition, the archaeological excavation underway in Edgefield is revealing material artifacts about the community of enslaved potters who labored in the area. Maggie Morehouse is the first graduate of the African Diaspora Studies Program at the University of California, Berkeley, completing her PhD in May 2001, and she teaches Southern History at Coastal Carolina University. I want to thank everyone for spending so much time tonight with Stephen Riley and I to discuss his great website. So good night, everyone, and remember, your ancestors left footprints, therefore you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives and beyond. You can continue this discussion on Afrogenius.com and the research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook page. Don't forget to listen to African Roots Podcast with Angela Walton-Raji on Friday morning, and remember to join Nurturing Our Roots with Antoinette Harrell on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is the guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp. Good night, and we look forward to you joining the show next week. Good night, Stephen.
Good night. Thank you.